Thank you for coming this evening. First of a few shiur, establishing boundaries of orthodoxy in the modern era. So this is a kind of a mix, a hybrid between a history shiur and a halacha shiur, kind of a history of thought shiur. Not just what happened, but also why and what the background is and what it teaches us. It's certainly true for tonight. So the history of the Hasidic movement, and are we Hasidim? Are we not? How do we fit in the Zman Hazeh? How do we fit into it today? Is a very interesting question. Where to start is an issue. Where to start is tough. The history of Hasidim starts with the Baal Shem Tov. However, in order to understand what the Baal Shem Tov was and what he was dealing with and why things came around that time, you even have to understand a couple hundred years earlier, or even more than 100 years earlier. The Jewish community in the early 1700s, the Baal Shem Tov passed away in 1760, but in the Jewish community in the 1700s was a very difficult time. The community was kind of coming along. It was kind of making it through, getting through year after year. In Europe, it was very difficult. There were many different types of wars. There were very different types of pogroms. Jews were constantly being kicked out of this country, kicked out of that country, kicked out of this city and that area, etc. They were maintaining their adherence to mitzvos for the most part, perhaps more out of necessity than out of any type of choice, but they were continuing on. We'll see the image of all these Jews being Beijer, Talmidei Chachamim, and major being big tzaddikim. They might have been big tzaddikim, they probably were not very big Talmidei Chachamim. The standard Jew was not sitting and learning hours and hours every day. That's what it seems. And they also weren't very happy. They weren't having a very good life because of all of the persecution from outside. And there was also significant issues from the inside. This is now coming about 100 years after the Shabtai Tzvi incident. So the Shabtai Tzvi incident was also a response to some of these same situations. The Jews were not doing very well. That's right, two pages. Jews were in very difficult circumstances. There was persecution. They were being chased out of this country and that country, right? And up came Shabtai Tzvi to lead the Jews, and he was going to be the Mashiach. Him and Nathan of Gaza, that was his trusty sidekick. Right? That was going to be the plan. And of course, we know what happened, that Shabtai Tzvi became false. So, and that led to a significant falling apart of the Jewish community, right? Shabtai Tzvi's revelation that he wasn't really the Messiah caused many Jews to leave the Derech, doubt everything, be very upset, very depressed, and all those kinds of things. So from then on, although there wasn't that much, we could have started this series from Shabtai Tzvi, but there wasn't that much rabbinic involvement with Shabtai Tzvi. It was more of a mass movement. The Rabbanim kind of got out of the way and said, let's wait and see. And there is some relationship with the Rabbanim to him, but whatever, that's not really a establishing boundary of orthodoxy in the modern era. However, the echoes of that were certainly still being heard 100 years later, and in a way are still very much heard ad yom hazeh, still heard until today. So it was into that situation that stepped the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov was a lived the first part of his life in seclusion. People really didn't know who he was. He stayed very quiet, etc. He revealed himself, quote-unquote, revealed himself in the middle of the 1730s, and over the last 25 years of his life, was able to gain a significant amount of followers. What was he getting followers to? What was the Baal Shem Tov introducing that didn't exist until that time? So there is an article, there was actually a book that was printed recently in honor of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. One of the articles was this. It was Dr. Rachel Elior, The Origin of Hasidism. Apparently, this Dr. Elior has many articles of on this topic, similar to this topic, Kabbalistic origins of Hasidim, etc. So this is one line from there. So I underlined a few of the things. He said, the Hasidic consciousness of divine presence, it's the underlying part, exists in every place, every time, every word, and every thought, and vice versa. Every concrete manifestation is perceived as a concealment of the divine being that sustains it. So the main thing that Hasidim taught, that is the first thing listed, probably the main thing that they taught, is the Kedusha of everybody. The Kedusha of everybody, of everything, of every moment, of every spot, of anything that happens. To recognize that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is present everywhere. And that, as we'll see probably a little bit later on, leads to a certain amount of being uplifted. Kadosh Baruch Hu is proud that Kadosh Baruch Hu is with us. There's also a great fear with that, as we'll see. But that's one thing that Hasidism taught. The Hasidic thought taught about the Kedusha of everything, the Kedusha of, and as the next paragraph says, this is not the next paragraph, it's a couple paragraphs later in that article, but the Baal Shem Tov saw every Jew as having the mystical potential to recognize and animate divine essence that diffuses everything. With that comes the idea that every Jew is holy. It's not just that there is tzaddikim that are close to Hashem and we're not, and we're nevuch. So we also have, everybody has something to contribute. Everybody has an neshama. Everybody has a tzelem elokim, and everybody has a responsibility because of that tzelem elokim. And we all have something to do in this world. That's a very uplifting thought. That's a very Hasidic idea. We, in a way, as we'll see, at the end of this, we're not quite sure what the Hasidim did that was so radical and so different than what we are today, which is why I said in the beginning maybe we're all Hasidim, right? But that was at that time, that was a original thought, and there is a danger associated with it. And the last thing I wrote, that everything was created on earth below to do great and wondrous things, to hint at the higher world, and which should not necessitate to say that everyone can reach the level of our teacher Moses of blessed memory. That's actually a Gemara, that everybody has the ability to reach to be like Moshe Rabbeinu, right? That imbibes everybody with a certain amount of holiness, a certain amount of worthiness, which is what Jews were looking for at that time. So that's what the Baal Shem Tov taught. It spread wildly. It spread wildly throughout mostly of Poland, not so much into Lithuania. Part of the reason for that is because for the reasons that we will see. So, yes?
So, you mentioned that the early part of Baal Shem life was in seclusion that we otherwise don't know, so it's probably not a fair question to ask what was his upbringing like, what was his learning like,
his learning was not like there was no yeshivas then, that comes 100
okay,
years later,
right.
Perhaps is one of the responses to the Hasidim, as we'll see. It pretty much, if you were smart enough, you know, some of us get together every morning and learn Daf Yomi every morning, right? And we learn, and production, we have the help of things like Art Scroll, we have the help of certain aids. If you were not smart enough to get it, you were just not smart enough to get it back in the day, right? The Gemara was a closed book. That's one of the miracles of what Art Scroll has done, right? They've made the Gemara an open book to everybody. So learning was, some people found the Rebbe and was able to find sustenance in it, and other people weren't. Where was he? Was Baal Shem Tov a massive Talmud Chacham? Was he not? I don't want to go there. I don't know.
Can we acknowledge that that's a, the fact that we don't know is significant in terms of what he's coming forth with as a product, because you know, we're so text based, we're so learning oriented in terms of what we and maybe it's not fair.
So that
300-400 years ago to think that, because as you just point out, there's a lot more dissemination of this
okay.
now. But you know, why does he? Or do we have any hint of anything that he did?
Well, we have a lot of hints where
he started from or where he was.
We have a lot of hints. The hints are coming. Okay. These stories that were passed on. So, best of most people's knowledge, he didn't write anything that we actually have. There may be a few letters here or there, but there's very little that we have that's from him. Most of the Torah, when you see books, Torahs of Baal Shem Tov, those are things that are his Talmidim that they say they heard from him, which Who knows, right? Yeah. But he was certainly able to, in the eyes of the Hasidim, in the eyes of most of the world, reveal certain truths about the world which wasn't revealed yet until that time, and was able with his charisma to be able to inspire enough people to spread those teachings throughout most of Jewish Europe. That's what we have. So there is, if one looks in the Tales of the Hasidim, I think it's written by Rav Zevin. It's published by Art Scroll. There's an English book there. It goes by Parsha. So there's a story that is in there that says that when the Baal Shem HaKadosh Baruch Hu was ready to send, and again, this might work with the introduction that Richard gave before, right, if you believe all of these stories, you're a fool. If you believe none, you're a heretic. Okay, so before the Baal Shem Tov was ready to, the Neshama was being ready to be sent down, so all the Malachim got up against the Kadosh Baruch Hu and said, you can't send down, it's not fair because he's going to inspire the entire world, and we're going to have no fault, and we're going to have no choice but to bring the Geula. It's not fair, you can't bring him down, he's going to inspire the world too much. So Kadosh Baruch Hu said, you're right, it is a problem, so I'll send down the neshama of the Noda B'Yehuda as well. That's the story that is told. So as a descendant of the Noda B'Yehuda, I'm not sure whether I should be taking offense or not, or what kind of or what that means for our action b'zman hazeh. I'm not sure. But the Noda B'Yehuda is one of the, even before we get to the Vilna Gaon, the Noda B'Yehuda lodges a protest. The Noda B'Yehuda fought very hard against a certain innovation that the Chassidim brought. Anybody know, before looking, anybody know what that is? So some of us do it, some of us don't. Initially, we don't do it because Rabbi Cohen will get very upset. But he writes, he has a tshuva. He deals with a couple of different things, but he writes as follows: the fourth thing that you ask about the benusach l'shem yichud, asher chadashim mekarav nispashi v'nitpas b'sidurim, that has become new and has been printed in some of the sidurim. Right. So he's sitting in Prague and he gets the sidur in the mail, and lo and behold, before some of the mitzvahs, it says l'shem yichud. Or hine muchanu mezuman l'kayim mitzvos aseh, right? That I'm hereby getting. And what are those little tefillos? Those little tefillos are, I'm about to do this mitzvah, etc., etc., etc. I'm getting myself in the right frame of mind. I'm building my kavanos. I'm getting myself ready. I'm ready, and now I say the bracha. So the Yehuda said, where did that come from? That's what the bracha is for. That's not the tefillah before the bracha is for. So what does he say? Right? Hine baza ani meshiv ad sha'atashu alni nusach amiraso yoser roi lishulim nemar kitov b'miraso. And I was asked, right, whether this is a good thing to say. Uladas zeh ra'ach chole b'doreinu b'al hadoro shalifnei zmanenu shalo yadu minusach zeh. Right? It's a sickness for our generations, and the generations before us never heard of this nusach. V'lo amru, they never said it by Yamelim Kol Yameim B'Torah Mitzvos, and they were involved in Mitzvos, and they didn't have any need to say that. Now, whether that's an exaggeration or not, okay. Hakol Api Torah Mitzvos, Hakol Api Torah, Val Api Apostmosh, Shadivrim Novim and Makor Mayim Chaim. Right? They were all smart and Tamidi Chachamim and Tzadikim, etc., etc. So Aval B'Doreinu, the next underlined part. He says Aval B'Doreinu Hazeh Ki Ozu Es Torah Hashem Makor Mayim Chaim Shnei Hatalmidim Bavli VeYerushalmi. Right? We've lost Torah Hashem and the source of our living waters, the two Talmidim, the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, Lachatzov Lehem Boros Nishvarim Umisnasim Berom Levavam Kol Echad Omer Anochi Haroa Veli Niftechu Shari Shemaim Vavari HaOlam Miskayim Elu Hemach Rivei Hador. He says, so everybody now gets up and says, I saw it through me, is the gates of heavens are going to open, and because of me, the world stands, right? And that's what's destroying our generation. Right, so this is some of the things that we already see this fight going on. Right, everybody gets up and says, "I'm royal, I'm a tzaddik, etc." Now we also see that it's nothing new that the Gedolei Hador are complaining that in previous generations everybody was Viktamid Chacham. They've been complaining about that for the last several hundred years. Right, V'al Hador Hayasom Hazeh. Now in this generation, I say, Ani Omer Yisharim Darchei Hashem V'Tzadikim Yelchu Bahem V'Chasidim Yichshulu Bam. Says Aniyo, I say Yishar, that the straight, the Darchei Hashem, and the righteous people will go in the ways of Hashem, and the Chasidim will Yichshalu Vahem, and the Chasidim will fall on it. Now, where does he get that from? That's actually a pasuk that we say in the Haftorah of. I'm tempted to say Shabbos Agadol. I forget, or Shabbos Tshuva. I mean, I think Shabbos Shuvah, but I'm not sure. But the ways of Hashem, the Hasidim go in the ways of Hashem, and the Hasidim fall in it. Now, the Pasuk doesn't say Hasidim, the Pasuk says Rishayim. That the Rishayim will fall on that road. So he's stuck in the word Hasidim. And he says, and therefore I'm very much against any of these new types of innovations. So the Nodav Yehuda was pretty tough against them. He was pretty strong. Yeah, there's nothing yet. But he was already pretty strong. In that story, Tales of the Hasidim, there's one more story about the Nodav Yehuda. One of his grandchildren, when they want to print his tshuvos, they actually had a, you see, many of the rabbanim in Europe had grandchildren and grandchildren that became chassidim. Rabbi Kiva Eger had a child who was a chassid, had a grandchild who was a chassid, and Nodav Yehuda had a grandchild that was a chassid. So one of his grandchildren, it's unclear to me whether it was that grandchild or a different one, wanted to publish the Nodav Yehuda's tshuvos. So he gets up to this tshuva, and it's a little insulting to the chassidim. So he asked one of the chassidish rabbanim, they said, should I maybe change it back to its original pasuk, to it says rishayim instead of chassidim? So the Rebbe said back to me, he says, no, you shouldn't change him. So your grandfather took the Rishayim and made them Hasidim. Now you want to take Hasidim and make them Rishayim? So that's not right. So they left it as is for posterity. That's pretty sharp. You like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyways, that's the Nodav Yehuda. I assume that was, I forgot to check the date, or figure out what the date was. It was 1750s, 1760s, etc. But things really took off in 1772 with the Chayrim from the Vilna Gaon. Now, the Vilna Gaon is the official, I don't know, official biography, I'm not sure, but the biography, the art scroll biography, based on the translation, is a translation, it's written by our someone who lives right nearby here, or his relatives in the area, Jonathan Rosenblum. So Jonathan Rosenblum was the translator for the art school biography of the Vilna Gaon. It's a translation from the Hebrew book Hagon HaChassid MiVilna. If one looks at the official Hebrew biography, there is no mention of the Vilna Gaon's fight with the Hasidim. That is, there's a little bit of a cover up there. There's no mention there. However, in Jonathan Rosenblum's biography, he puts the chapter in, and he writes at the bottom, in the original edition, the chapter didn't exist. It did exist in manuscript form, but the author decided to leave it out. This is based on the manuscript that the author gave me, and we worked through it together and not publishing it now, because no biography of the Vilna Gaon is complete without a mention of his fight with the Hasidim. So it was made it back into the history books again. So the Vilna Gaon, and it's very much out of character. The Vilna Gaon eschewed any type of rabbanus, any type of communal authority. He didn't want anything to do with anything that was going on in the city. He just wanted to sit and learn. Now, the Vilna Gaon was paid by the city. He did earn a salary from the Jewish community of the city, but he was not the Dayan, he was not the Rav, and which made it a little bit uncomfortable to be the Dayan or the Rav, knowing that the Vilna Gaon was right nearby. But he pretty much stayed out of all matters. He had his own learning schedule. The Vilna Gaon was not obviously not a normal person, way beyond not a normal person. I mean, somebody who slept 2 hours in half-hour doses 4 times over the course of 24 hours. That is, and these aren't just legends, these are things that were witnessed and etc. But the Vilna Gaon, where he did get involved, was in this issue with Hasidim. The Vilna Gaon saw, and most of the Charam, he was not the first one, this was not the first Charam that was signed. That was signed by other towns. However, they realized that it wouldn't be meaningful until the Vilna Gaon would put his stamp of approval on it. And from 1772 for the next, till his death in 1797, anything that came out of Vilna being against the Hasidim, the Vilna Gaon's signature appeared on it. So there, and at the end of his life, towards the end of his life, rumors started going around that the Vilna Gaon had backtracked a little bit and that he wasn't so anti, etc. And he actually, towards the end of his life, wrote one letter saying, no, all the things I said about the Hasidim I still believe to be true. And then there were rumors that that was a forgery, so he wrote another letter saying, in that letter that I saw that you claim is a forgery, it wasn't really a forgery and it's really true and I really hold. So the Vilna Gaon didn't backtrack on these positions. So what did the Chayrim say? So this is taken, he did not write it in English. This is taken from this book. This book I bought several years ago, thinking, oh, I'd love to really know what's in that book. This gave me the opportunity to go through parts of it, but the Hasidic movement and the Gaon of Vilna It's written by someone, Elijah Judah Shachet, who it seems like is a conservative rabbi, but Rabbi Beryl Wein has a nice letter on the back saying that, no, this is a very important book, etc. And he introduces it by saying, you know, I very much associate with the Hasidic tradition, but I also discovered that I'm a descendant of the Vilna Gaon. So, like, what do I do with this? My worlds have collided, and that's why I decided to go ahead and write this book. So this has really amazing stuff, really amazing documents, really amazing different types of things. If one saw recently, if one is a follower of the Yeshiva World News, so there was a copy of one of the of the Haramim of the Vilna Gaon that was recently sold at auction. Anybody notice that? But I didn't understand, because it was from the 1800s. I didn't really understand how that worked. It was a copy of a copy, whatever, but it was the oldest known printing of an edict that was signed by the Vilna Gaon. So what particularly were his problems? So here we go. Our brethren in Israel, you are currently already informed of the tidings thereof. Our fathers never dreamed that the sect of the suspects, Chashudim instead of Chasidim, right? Chashudim means suspect, so you put it right. So it has been formed. Now, obviously, it doesn't have the whole thing, but it says this: who meet together in separate groups and deviate in their prayers. So that's actually two different complaints. We'll go through this piece by piece. Who meet together in separate groups was an issue. They're just on their own. The reason they gave for that is because they changed the Nusach HaTfilah. They went from Nusach Ashkenaz, which is what we do, to Nusach Ari, or to Nusach Kabbalistic, Nusach, more Sephardic in nature, and therefore they require to have their own Minyanim. Now, having your own Minyanim is a problem, because that means you're separating from the community. Separating from the community, he does have a small chapter in this book. He doesn't really say that this is the reason. He doesn't go that far. But it is something to keep in mind, that if the community is breaking up, there is a major monetary aspect to that. Right? The Jewish community financial structure was based on there being one community, one Rav, one Kehila per town. And if you're going to now break that up, there's a major risk in that. So, just throwing that out. And then change their Nusach HaTfilah, that was a complaint. It goes on to the next one. This is, I hope you can you make out the underlines? These were things that I added in. Even an ignoramus is capable, incapable of reciting the Shema Yisrael, meaning upon joining them comes to merit in the world and the next one in 1 hour. Meaning you take a couple of these beliefs and all of a sudden you have, right? You could teach things that people who don't necessarily know that much will be able to come very close, in theory, close with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. There are the same who in the middle of Shmona Esrei interject obnoxious alien words in a loud voice. So there were, he has a very large chapter on this. Fascinating. I don't want to repeat too many of them because it could disturb your tefillah for weeks to come. Not recognizing things that they do and some of the things that we might do based on some of the things that they did. But some of the, they would call things out in the middle of tefillah. They would do somersaults in the middle of tefillah. They would jump up and they would start saying things in Yiddish that was outside of the Siddur in the middle of tefillah. So in some ways it's very exciting. But what was the reason for it? The reason for it was we have to get ourselves in the right frame of mind, etc. Now, what's going to be the complaint against it? The complaint against it is, well, wait a second, we have a tefillah that you need to get through, and you're not doing it properly. Continue on and say, I'm not sure if does he have the thing about Zmanim here, but Zmanim is obviously an issue. Next is the study of the Torah is neglected by them entirely. So we'll get to that. But they, I keep saying we're going to get to that, and we're already 20 minutes into this year. But the Torah study is neglected by them entirely. They are, which might have been the biggest issue for the Vilna Gaon. The primacy of Talmud Torah was starting to slacken. Similarly, ugly deeds on their part have been fully delineated for us. So there is in Hasidic thought, if you assume everything has Kedusha, if you assume everything has holiness, right, that means everything has holiness. And that means even things that would qualify as chataim, even things that would qualify as sins, there's an amount of kedusha there, and there's an amount of kedusha there. There is what to be gained in Hasidic thought, or in some streams of Hasidic thought, from coming close to a sin and not actually violating it, or to seeing the value in certain types of sins. Right? So you can imagine that being somewhat of a dangerous thought. But there is stories of Hasidic heroism that he details in this book, particularly early Hasidim, of people that would find themselves in places which could very easily lead to moral activity, and the ability to survive it. And the tzaddik always survives it. It's very good that the tzaddik survives it, but maybe some other people didn't survive it. Right? So that is that was one of the major issues against the Hasidim. We should point out, and really constantly point out, that not all Hasidim are the same, right? Today there's many different streams of Hasidim, and back then there are many different streams of Hasidim. There are more that were extreme in these somewhat radical practices, and there are some that weren't, etc. Okay, so for the next, every day for them is like a holiday, meaning every day is like a simcha. It goes into, for they turn over like wheels, etc. And if you look at the very last line, he says, so what do you do with them? So long as they do not make a full atonement of their own accord, they should be scattered and driven away, so that not two heretics remain together, for the disbanding of their association is something for a boon for the world. Right? So this is the Cherem against the Hasidim. This is one of them. He has about 10 different editions in this book of things that came out over the years, but they all pretty much sound like this. There are some other issues that he doesn't necessarily mention. There's a whole issue with Shechita knives, that the Hasidim made new Shechita knives, I think out of steel, that were much more sharper than the previous ones were. So they probably were better. And the truth is, today you hear the term Hasidish Shechita. What does that mean? That means that they're using these types of knives. But that's an innovation. Anytime you have any type of innovation, that's going to raise significant issues. So those are the main things: lack of Torah study, some issues with in terms of ugly deeds, quote unquote, tefillah issues, separating from the community, things like that. So that is, the pictures are, that's Baal Shem Tov, that's the Noda Behuda, and that is the Vilna Gaon at the bottom. This, we got the pictures going. Okay, so what do we go from here? So I would like to go into a little bit more some of these issues. However, it's very difficult. I mean, I am not an expert on early Hasidic literature. I'm not sure how many people are. It's also not so easy to go through these all these different things and try to find evidence, etc. But there is a book that came out a little bit later, a little bit after the Vilna Gaon, called the Nefesh HaChaim. Now, this isn't so fair, because the Nefesh HaChaim was known today, at least, as the prime Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. However, he was the prime Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, but he probably is the most responsible for keeping this from actually becoming a schism. He also did meet, although the Baal Shem Tov passed away in the 60s, the main Hasidic leader later on, during this era, was Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi was the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he is probably the most outspoken leader of the Hasidim that could have the strongest connection with what became known as the Misnagdim, those that are against the Hasidim. The Baal HaTanya, in fact, in 1972, went to see the Vilna Gaon, and he wanted to meet with him. There's many legends about what that story was. At the end of the day, the Vilna Gaon refused to meet with him. In the Art Scroll biography, it says that the Rav Shneur Zalman said that if only the Vilna Gaon would look into my eyes, he would see that I'm not an apikoros. He would see that I'm not a heretic. So he writes in the footnote, Jonathan Rosenblum writes in the footnote, he said, that might be true. He said, that might be true, but according to the Vilna Gaon, that's irrelevant. Because the Vilna Gaon wasn't necessarily as concerned with their heresy as much as for the tzaddikim, as much as he was concerned about what that would impact on the Baal HaBatim. I mean, very nice, you're not an apikoros, but all your chassidim are. So that's not necessarily going to solve the problem. There is, I put it at the end, but truth is, we could take it out. As I mentioned, there are many legends about this meeting. I'll share one that is able to come across. Rabbi Cohen told me this, and I was able to subsequently find it. On the second to last page, at the bottom right hand, Right, there is a section that's from Divrei Harav. Divrei Harav is one of Rav Schechter's Sfarim that he puts together of the teachings of Rav Soloveitchik. So it has the following story in it, that apparently there was once a Yutes Kislev is the big day for Lubavitcher Hasid, and why? Because that's the day the Alter Rebbe got out of jail. So they always have big parties and Fabringen in that night. So apparently there was one taking place in Boston, and Rav Soloveitchik went. Rav Soloveitchik went to this Fabringen, and they asked him to speak. So he said, okay. So he offered to speak. Rav Soloveitchik is very close to Hasidim, as hopefully we'll have the time to see and appreciate this evening. So he told them, he says, in the house of Volozhin, meaning from the base Hagrat of Chaim Volozhin, of which Rav Soloveitchik was a part of, he was a direct descendant, well, not the direct descendant of the Grub, but I believe a direct descendant of Chaim Volozhin, he says, when the Machlokas started, so the Ha'admor Hazaken, meaning the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and Rav Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev. Now, in the books, it's not Rav Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev; it's someone else. Went to Vilna, Ladavri Magar, to speak to the Gra. Himhachu leKloyes Shal HaChassid. They went to the Chassid's Kloyes, right? The Vilna Gon was known as the Chassid, right? Which predated the term Chassidim, but he was known as the Chassid, right? Sham hayahagra Yosef Elom Rebeliyas Abayis, and there he used to learn. Admor Azakin Rebeliyvi Yitzak Hitchil Alos Madrigas Alchader Hagra. They walked up the steps. Aval Miyak Shehirgi Shemishu Rotzali Chanes. But as soon as he realized that someone wanted to come in, Sagar Asadels Velonosin Lahem Lichanes. He closed the door and wouldn't let them in. Hasebul Lekach Haisa Shekasher Hagra Ra Es Toar Pnei Haadmor Hazakin. Own voice shine siz govin oin vas para ka hamoshech eight ar get, which I don't know what that means, but I assume it means something like the next words, which say v'kam yafeshu ahaya ve'eza koch mashicha shahayalo, how beautiful he was and how what kind of strength of drawing people after him he had. He was concerned that if the Valatani would speak to him, he would be successful and turn the Vilna Gaon into a Chassid. And he didn't want that. All right. Until they both left to spread their Chassidus. Therefore, he jumped out the window. That's the conclusion of the story. That's the legend that was told in the Soloveitchik family. But there are other stories about what exactly happened why the Vilna Gaon refused to see him. But at the end of the day, Vilna Gaon refused to see him. Out went the Charamim for the next 30 years. That was the life that was going on. In things kind of settled down in the 1780s, 1790s, there weren't too many charim that came out at that point. People kind of started settling into doing their own thing. In 1797, the Vilna Gaon passed away on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, and the Hasidim danced. The Hasidim danced, they were happy, they expressed joy at the passing of the Vilna Gaon. That got people upset once again, and all of a sudden people started ending up in prison because people started telling on each other and accusing each other. That kind of reignited the flames one more time. After that comes the Nefesh HaChaim. So the Nefesh HaChaim was actually printed by Rav Chaim Volozhiner the year after he passed away, I believe in around 1820 or so. The Rav Chaim Volozhiner, again, the Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, is notoriously absent from the Charamim. He doesn't sign any of the edicts against the Hasidim. Why is that? So probably. So why is that? So Rabbi Norman Lamb, he should live in BUL, wrote his doctorate on Rav Chaim Volozhiner. That was his original doctorate. And he published a book in 1989 entitled Torah Lishma, Torah for Torah's Sake, in the works of Rav Chaim of Volozhiner and his contemporaries. I didn't even know about this, but I came across it. I'm sitting here in Philadelphia. Where am I going to find this book? Rabbi Lamb's granddaughter lives in Philadelphia now. Rabbi Sinensky's wife is Rabbi Lamb's granddaughter, so I sent him an email. You wouldn't by any chance have this book? Oh, I do. Wonderful. So I was able to get a hold of it. The first very good stuff in it. So he points out in this book that Rav Chaim Volozhiner probably was such a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon that he paskened like him in a very important matter. The Vilna Gaon writes in the beginning of... Rav Chaim Volozhiner writes. Rav Chaim Volozhiner actually wrote the introduction of the Vilna Gaon on Shulchan Aruch. So in that introduction, he talks about the importance of intellectual independence. The idea that people have, you shouldn't just learn the Shulchan Aruch and just, you know, just assume that he's right, but you actually have to go to the Gemaras and analyze the sources, and you might come to your own conclusions. So be it. Everybody is responsible to learn. Everybody is responsible to develop and learn as much as they can. So probably he was such a Talmud of the Gra that he had intellectual independence and said, you know what, I disagree. I don't think the Hasidim have to be put into Chayrim. The way Rabbi Lam explains it is the attitude of the Vilna Gaon was no way, while the attitude of Rav Chaim Volozhiner was yes but. And the yes buts are very important and were probably the most important matter to make sure that there wasn't a schism and ultimately things joined together. So we can see a few of the examples. I don't know if we'll get through all of them. The Nefesh HaChaim is here. Somebody wrote the last couple of years, Rabbi Avram Yaakov Finkel actually wrote what he says is a translation of the Nefesh HaChaim. This would not qualify as a translation. It's more of a... in someplace else I remember reading, he writes, this isn't a translation, this is like a summary, my approach based on the Nefesh HaChaim. There are parts of the Nefesh HaChaim that are quite Kabbalistic. He kind of skips those. And other parts of paragraph, I put the translation in here, but it's not a translation. It's kind of a... there's got to be a better scholarly word for it. Like a summary type in English of what's going on the Hebrew side. So, where are we here? So let's go page 2, which begins issues with mitzvos. So on the top left, Nefesh HaChaim 4:1. Nefesh HaChaim 4:1. Shar Dalid. Nefesh HaChaim 4 is the section where he deals with the importance of Talmud Torah. So he writes, so that little part that's underlined in the middle, he writes, the Gamra'a Chola Yoser Mizeh, there is a very bad illness that's worse in this generation. Shesovrim Bedaitim She'etzek HaTor Below Dveikus Ein Klum Ulo Shum Toelas. As the Hasidim think that involving oneself in Torah without Dveikus Hashem, without first connecting to Hashem, is worthless, and there's no point to it. And he goes on to say that that's not true. I mean, obviously the most important, the ideal would be Torah Lishma, but say, I'm not going to learn Torah until I feel totally connected with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Well, I don't think the Daf Yomi Shir would have gotten started on time too often. Right? You'll learn, and hopefully you achieve those moments of Dveikus. So that's Rav Chaim, that's one of his arguments. He has issues with mitzvot, so In his introduction to Shar Dalid, there is an introduction that is quite large, where the Nefesh HaChaim comes closest to having a full frontal attack on the Hasidim. So some of the things he writes there is as follows. Lizos hizar ben nafshecha ma'ot she'al yisiyacha yitzrecha limor she'ikra kol tir she'tehei ach asu kol yamel letar machshavascha karoi. He says, avoid the yitzahara to say that the main point is you're not going to do anything until you have totally clear thoughts. Skip to the underlined part. And any time that the heart of a person is not full and ready to do the mitzvahs with a full 100% connection and purity of thought, etc., it's not considered a mitzvah at all. Meaning, don't say like that. Don't listen to the Yitzhahara that tells you, oh, don't bother doing the mitzvah. You're not in the right frame of mind. So that's what the Hasidim say. Meaning, don't listen to that Yitzhahara. And he goes on and says, because really, you know, just doing the mitzvah is very important. And he has this famous line towards the bottom at the end. He says, "V'chimay nafkusa bein zeh." Right, the next paragraph down on the bottom, 5 lines before, you know, the underlined part. "V'nafkusa bein zeh l'misha haya tokeya shofar bekavana atzuma b'leil rishon shel Pesach." What's he talking about? He says, let's say a person gets to Seder night and they want to have their matzah. And they concentrate so hard on their matzah, try to get in the right frame of mind of getting all the kavanos necessary in order to eat the matzah and the full mitzvah, etc. And he's working and meditating and moving, etc. And by the time he's ready, what time is it? It's 2 in the morning. Right, so 2 in the morning is after Chatzot, it's after this man of matzah. So he says, why? How is it any better to do that? So what's the difference between that and somebody who blows shofar with the right kavanah on the first night of Pesach? Meaning, it's not this man to eat matzah, it's not this man to blow shofar. Right? the makom mitzvah achilas kazayis matzah, ochel bekazayis matzah Rosh Hashanah, or eats a kazayis matzah Rosh Hashanah. Umisana be'erev yom kippurim, and he fasts on erev yom kippur. V'yom kippurim no talulav, and then what he does on yom kippur, he takes his lulav. Be'makom mitzvahs inoy, ve'yei makom l'torah, and what's going to happen to the place of Torah? So that's one of the famous arguments of the Nefesh HaChaim, right? That you have to do the mitzvahs, right? Just because you don't have the right kavana, it doesn't mean that the mitzvahs just get pushed aside totally until one has the right kavana. The next section, 4:8, which you go back to the left side of the page, right? So that's
this is the Nefesh HaChaim.
This is all Nefesh HaChaim. So I realize it's a little bit unfair because I'm not also putting the Valatanya on the page as well. I just want to demonstrate the issues, the issues that he's dealing with, and the way how the Nefesh HaChaim brings them back in. I mean, Nefesh HaChaim is using this kind of as a foil to say this is the proper approach. Mm-hmm. You have to do the mitzvah.
So that he, somebody who got a siddim, would say, don't do it because you're not in the right frame of mind.
Right. So his claim is that's what the chassidim say. Is that what the chassidim say? Is that what all of them say? So he writes in I believe, I forget which one, in Rabbi Lamb's book or in this book, he says that he assumes that he thinks the Baal Shem Tov davened at the right time every day. And he thinks the Magid, he thinks the Rabbanim were the one that davened the right time every day. He says, other people then take it a little too far. Okay.
From what we can see today, that's probably a...
It's a skip to the next one where it says intro 4:8. He writes, "V'yatav korei al tidmish milibio tesis." I didn't make these things up. Rather, I looked into it and I understand these are the things that's going on. Bottom left, issues with learning, where he writes, "V'gam kama me'osan asher korvan elukim yach beitzun." They have a desire to come close with Hashem. Hima bachru liasim li'tol ko ikalimudim b'sifrei yiru musar kol hayamim. They've established that their main learning is going to be in Yira and Musar, etc. And not enough Torah. I mean, not enough, that's Torah, but not enough Halacha, not enough knowledge, things like that. Okay, so all of those are kind of, one could say external issues, though. I mean, those are issues with, they're about mitzvos, they're about things that are done. But in truth is, I'm not sure the Hasidish or Rebbeim would object. Some would, I mean, some do this, and even Ad Yom Hazeh, there are some that do it. You could see some Hasidish shtibels that they have times for shachar, not shtibels, but you know, Hasidish places. There's one place I remember walking by, it says on it, Zmani Shachar 6:37, 7:38, 8:39, 9:30, 10, Ve'elach, meaning, and keep going. you could see these kinds of behaviors still going today. I mean, it is important to recognize that the Hasidim today, you shouldn't just place them in. We shouldn't just say, oh, these are the same. Really not. If one would compare the early Hasidim, especially the ones that are kind of being described in that letter, the place you would look is probably to see the best example of it would probably be to go to Uman on Rosh Hashanah, I think. Right there, you kind of see some of these kinds of activities of people jumping and people screaming and that kind of stuff. Hmm?
Where?
Uman, and you go to Nachman's Kever in Russia, right? So that's where you would see. If one wants to, I actually have a documentary that I showed in Phoenix once, entitled Yippee, where somebody actually videoed. A filmmaker went to. This was a couple of years ago when things weren't as big, but he actually filmed his experience in Uman for Rosh Hashanah. So, you know, jumping up and down. And then the excitement and not so much learning, right? So you could kind of see that in that segment. Not so much with most Hasidim, with many Hasidim today. But the part, none of that is necessarily heresy. Maybe, I mean, if we're denying the importance of mitzvos. But in terms of a conception of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is one of the main arguments, so the Nefesh HaChaim takes that on, and at the end of the day, isn't so different than the Hasidim, which is kind of what makes the Nefesh HaChaim such an important work. The Nefesh HaChaim says, let me tell you our conception of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the Baal HaTanya says, I'm going to tell you my conception of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And then you compare the two books. I remember I was listening to Rav Shechter talk about it. You read them. They have some machlokas here about something that who knows what in the world they're talking about already. Something, yeah. And he said, the main things they all agree on. It just wasn't necessarily revealed yet. And that was what the Gro was nervous about. And we'll see exactly what they were nervous about. He says in section Shar Gimel is probably the most difficult section of the Nefesh HaChayim, where he spells many of the things out. We'll do it very quickly. Some of these sources we worked on, the shir that I gave all the way in the beginning of my stay here, Does God Sleep In on Sunday Mornings? It's available online. And Who Is God? We gave a shir on a couple of years ago, right? So this is kind of taken from that. But Nefesh HaChayim writes, he compares knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a coal, and coals are very useful and coals are very helpful, but you have to be very careful with them that you don't work on it too much, right? You shouldn't be involved with it too much. As the Mishnah puts it, warm yourself by the fire of the sages, but don't necessarily mean stay a little bit far, don't necessarily get in too close. Don't get too close. He says, this is the issue. Vihinei, the next step, Vihinei, kan betevas makom gankein, agam shepashit muvan, aval kishin daktipo nimsa sheklolo v'ramzubaze od inyan gadol. You see a major thing in the term makom. What's he talking about? What does it mean that Hashem is called a makom? Pirusho bereshis rabba al pasuk by yifka b'makom, that he reached the place, right? B'shem Rabbi Reishay b'shem Reish. I'm not sure that is Amar. If they ma mechanin shemo shal kadosh baruch hu b'karnos al makom. What does it mean when Hashem is called makom? Shu makomo shal olam ve'ein olamu makomo. That Hashem is the place of the world, and the world is not His place. Right? What does that mean? The Hashem is the world, and the world is not where. I mean, Hashem is not. I mean, sometimes our conception of God is. What does it mean that Hashem Echad? So our conception is generally Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. Then in the category of gods, there's only one God. Like in the category of Rabbi Gross, there's only one Rabbi Gross. In the category of rabbis in Philadelphia, there is 10, 15, 20 rabbis. In the category of members of our shul, there's whatever members of shul. And the categories of God, there's only one. Right? There's only, but that's not the case. God is not, can't be categorized. God is above the category. Right? God is, the place of the world is not the place where God lives. The world, the God is the place where the world lives. That all is contained within a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the main argument, and that's the main chiddush. It's not really a chiddush. It means that he's pointing out that this goes back many years. But teaching this to the masses was what was new that the Chassidim did, and what made people very nervous. Which was Rabba so Parsha v'Tanchum v'Parsha Tzitz v'Yom Hashem Hinei Makom Iti. I'm Rabbi Yochanan. I'm Rabbi Rivach. Asri tefela li ve'en ani tafel la'asri. That it's all tafel. It's all subjugated to me. I'm not subjugated to it. Etc., etc. And the same thing with the next section, there was Nefesh HaChayim 3.5, where he talks about that is kind of the answer to the problem. What's the problem with saying that all is part of a Kadosh Baruch Hu? What's the problem with saying, and therefore we're all kind of part of Hashem? What's the problem? The problem is, if all is part of Hashem, that's what we call pantheism. Right, that's what we call saying, well, all is part of Hashem. Hashem is in control of everything. What does it matter what I do? Because it's just God doing it anyways. So that's a very dangerous attitude to have, because then I don't have to make any decisions. Right? I don't have. I could choose this, I could choose that, but it doesn't matter anymore. Right? Because all is godly. In Nefesh HaChayim 3.5, he describes the answer to the paradox, which is that there's different perspectives, that there's God's perspective, there's our perspective. If you remember back in this year, we discussed it, that we had this exercise where I had everybody close their eyes and imagine a person that you created, right? And if that person could be granted free will, so that's the same thing as us, right? That in a way we control that person. But yet the person has an ideal of free will. How does that work? Ultimately, it's a paradox, and we can't really understand it. But we try over the course of our lifetime. You know, it's good that we can't understand what that gives us something to work on over the course of our lives. But that was the main. That was. A big challenge, right? That was what was revealed, and that's perhaps what the Vilna Gaon got very upset about. The Vilna Gaon gives other interpretations of what it means, makom, but ultimately the Nefesh HaChayim explained it in a very similar way to the way the Baal HaTanya explained it, and although these are dangerous thoughts, they once the genie is out of the bottle, the genie is out of the bottle. And these have become commonplace once it's printed in Nefesh HaChaim. And once the Nefesh HaChaim is printed in English, so these ideas have been taught, and you know, I've taught them, and others have taught them, and I believe they're very meaningful for people, because it takes a Kadosh Baruch Hu, it takes God out of being this one being that's God and separate and distant, and of God being the all-knowing and us being the all-stupid, God being the infinite and us being the infinitesimal, all that kind of stuff, and turns a Kadosh Baruch Hu into something, you know, into a being that works with us, etc., etc. So that is the fight, and how the Nefesh HaChaim in a way brought them together. There is in Rabbi Lam's book here, he quotes a story from the Makor Baruch. The Makor Baruch is Rabbi Yechiel Epstein, who lived in the late 1800s. This is a famous line that had. What does the aftermaths? So you see there, the second line, it says, "Thus Rav Baruch HaLevi Epstein reports the following comment made by the third of the Chabad Tzaddikim, Rav Nachum Mendel of Lubavitch, to the former's father, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, a confirmed misnagid, Ashrei Shlomenu, right? How wonderful is us. Anshei Shlomenu, meaning the Hasidim, do not appreciate the great kindness that the Gaon of Vilna did for us when he opposed us. For were it not for the controversy, then there would have been cause to worry, for the ecstatic fervor and uplifted spirit inherent in the new movement would have ultimately resulted in the scorching of the Talmud by the fire of Kabbalah, and the hidden Torah would have diminished the image of the revealed Torah. If it wasn't for the fact that the Vilna Gaon argued, at least that story that we had earlier, the Nudav Yehuda argued, and that there were misnagdim, and there were people that tried, you know, that cooled the flames, so to speak, so that people would have gone too far. They would have gone too far, they would have left the Talmud, they would have left Halacha, Torah, Jewish Judaism would have become a meditating religion, and things would have been over. I mean, they give credit to the Vilna Gaon, and in fact, today, the Vilna Gaon is treated in somewhat ambiguous terms. They don't like the fact of some of the names he got called, but they do respect him as a tzaddik and etc. There is a story in here at the very end, put in the Hasidic Maisa category, that they say that Rav Levi Yitzchak Mibradishev, once after the Vilna Gaon died, all of a sudden in the middle of shul says, "I just had a vision that." That the Vilna Gaon is at the gates trying to figure out whether he's going to get in, and they looked at everything and they realized that he's a 100% total, without a doubt, tzaddik, with one exception, his opposition to the Hasidim. So what do I do? So they said, for your kapara, we want you, you have to listen to a shir of one of the Hasidish Rebbeim. Vilna Gaon responded by saying, I'd rather go to hell. That's what he said. I'd rather suffer. So he said, okay. So they're leading him down, and the dafe of the Gemara that he learned over the course of his lives go up and protect him, and it's impossible for him to go down. That's the story that was told in the Hasid. So he brings that as an example of like the difficulty in dealing with the Vilna Gaon if you're a Hasid. Like, how do you work with that, etc. Where does this play out, Bizman Hazeh? On the last page, those are three pictures. The top picture is of Moshe Soloveitchik, the middle picture is Rav Soloveitchik, the bottom picture is Dr. Isidore Tursky, Marty's uncle, Allah Shalom. And in a way, Rav Soloveitchik, many people represent the synthesis, many people, even even the Nefesh HaChaim himself, Rav Chaim Volozhin, allowed Hasidim into Volozhin. Ultimately, over the next 150 years, the controversy really died down in the 1840s, 1850s, because of the Haskalah, which we'll discuss next week, the rise of the Reform movement meant that they had to band together in order, you know, and team up in order to fight that. And ultimately, families intermarried, and today is pretty much one people. All the Rabbi Rakefet in his tapes always points out that all the Litvisha yeshivas have all become Hasidish. You can tell right away by looking at them. He says everybody wears a black hat. He says when I was in Lakewood in the 50s, Only one person in the entire yeshiva wore a black hat, and his first name was Aaron, and his last name was Cutler. Right? Other than that, nobody wore a black hat. So now they all do. That's the idea, and the idea of Das Torah that there is Bizman Hazeh, the idea of following the Rebbe, right? Many of those are Hasidic ideas that have seeped into the Lithuanian world, and not too many Lithuanians survived the war. The Lithuanian yeshivas are filled with people, Poland, Hungarian, etc., which are mostly Hasidic enclaves, and mostly things have merged together. So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik still in a way fought against it. There's a story actually on the end of page 3. I put in a story, there it is, on the bottom right, related by the Rav and the Essay Halachic Man, sold in Rabbi Rakefet's book about the Rav, that once my father was standing in a synagogue platform Rosh Hashanah ready and prepared to guide the order of the sounding of the shofar. He was going to be the Baal Makri. The shofar sounder, a God-fearing Chabad Chassid. There's many stories where Soloveitchik grew up in the Hasidish town and his father was the Rav of the Hasidish town. Why that is for another time. So the shofar sounder, God-fearing Chabad Chassid, who was very knowledgeable in the mystical doctrine of the Alter Rebbe of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, now we know exactly what this means, began to weep. He starts crying. My father turned to him and said, "Do you weep when you take the lulav? Why then do you weep when you sound the shofar? They're both mitzvos." Right, so there you see the conflict of the chassid and the misnagid. Right, it's a mitzvah. You're going to do a mitzvah. Stop crying about it. Then realize, I'm blowing the shofar. Right, so how do you put the two together? I remember once somebody was giving me an argument about he was upset about something Chabad was doing, not in this town. It wasn't here. It was someplace else. And he said to me, like, do you know that they still call you misnagdim? Like, they still refer to you behind your... He said to me, they still refer to you as a misnagid. Meaning, anybody who's not... Right, do you consider yourself a misnagid? So in some people, the fight still lives on. So there you see the conflict between the two. Rav Soloveitchik, and the part that I said, the 174, he says, what do I know about Chabad? He describes growing up in this Chabad town, and he describes that he learned Tanya. He says, even today, I still know sections of Tanya by heart, especially the Shar Yichud, Vahamuna, etc. And in the bottom paragraph, he says, I vividly recall how Rav Baruch would teach Tanya during this period. My father would visit the Chadarim in Kaslovich on either Thursday or Friday, meaning he was in yeshiva. His Rebbe would teach Tanya, and his father would come around to check on how the boys were learning. But his father thought they were learning Gemara. So the Malamed had luckouts who would inform him when the Rebbe was on his way. Immediately, the volumes of Tanya would be hidden. The Tanya was a small book and it was easy to hide. We would quickly take out the large Gemaras and shout as if deeply involved in Talmudic study. Somehow we always shouted when we studied Gemara. My father would look around and not notice anything out of the ordinary. So that's where Soloveitchik learned Tanya in yeshiva. That was the story. So the story goes that his father went and brought him to Rav Chaim, his Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, meaning Rav Yosef Soloveitchik's grandfather, and Rav Chaim turned to him and says, "What are you learning in yeshiva?" And he started saying, "Tanya, right? Alti tzadik harbe, alti rasha, right?" And his grandfather said, "Well, something's not right here." And that's when Rav Soloveitchik left Cheder and started learning with his father. But as the next story shows, he still had a very warm place in his heart for Tanya. That when Rav Soloveitchik was, his Talmidim used to go and learn with him in Boston during the summer. Not in Boston, but in Onset. They used to go to, which is outside of Boston. So he used to go there. I'm not sure Rabbi Cohen ever went, but they used to go and learn with him. So, and he, every year he would learn with them something different. And one year he wanted to learn with them Tanya. And the boys weren't so happy, or he would teach it to them, and the boys weren't so happy about it. So this story is told over by Rabbi Ganak, that Rav Soloveitchik told the story that there was a dreary day in the Hasidish town, and the Rebbe began to speak, and the followers huddled around him to digest every word. After the words of Torah, the Hasidim once again broke out in tumultuous song till the whole building shook. Suddenly the snow melted, the grass sprouted forth, the barren trees bloomed again, and the birds joined the Hasidim in praising the Almighty. As the hour was late, the Beis HaLevi glanced at his watch and suddenly told the students in a sharp tone, "Nunu, it's time for Mincha!" The spiritual rapture of the gathering was broken. The weather outside once again turned bleak, the trees once again became bare, and the earth returned to the barren wilderness. After finishing the story, the Rav turned to a student who was not happy about studying the classic Hasidic text and explained, "The story's about you." And also I put in the last section we've done these last sections before as well, from Dr. Isidore Twersky's book, who was Hasidish, where he describes, you know, how to put these two together, right? The idea of Hasid, halacha is the indispensable manifestation and prescribed concretization of an underlying and overriding spiritual essence, meaning there's halacha in manifestation. There's Torah in manifestation and Torah in essence. And the job is manifestation is the mitzvah, that you eat this, you shake this, you say this, you do, right, all the mitzvahs that we do, and essence is what we're supposed to feel. And ultimately the two of them are supposed to be bridged, right? The right side is the section where the Rav describes what he learned from his mother about feeling the arm of Hashem resting upon his frail shoulder, and that's ultimately the goal. So, you know, we go back in time and we see these two opposite schools of thought, and relatively quickly, over a couple of decades, I think they became merged, and you know what we have that might be on the path towards Mashiach, when we have different strands of Torah, different strands of thought, different people will fall on different parts of the spectrum. But ultimately, I think it's been proven over time, it's been accepted by Klal Yisrael, that all of it is part of Torah, and ultimately it will lead to Geula. Okay. Thank you for coming.